Chapter 12. At Home with My Memories. Toad News Network was the top news station. Lydia Startwright, their top reporter. If there was a top event, you could bet your top dollar that Toad would make it their top story. When Tunbridge Wells was given to the Russians as war reparations, there was no topper story. Except, that is, the mammoth migrations, speculation on Bonzo the Wonderhound's next movie, or whether Lola Vavoom shaved her armpits or not. My father said that it was delightfully odd and dangerously self-destructive. Quirk of humans that we were far more interested in pointless trivia than in genuine news stories. Thursday next, A Life in Specops. Since I was still on official leave pending the outcome of the SO1 hearing, I went home and let myself into my apartment, kicked off my shoes and poured some pistachios into Pickwick's dish. I made some coffee and called Bowden for a long chat, trying to find out what else had changed since Landon's eradication. As it turned out, not much. Anton had still been blamed for the charge of the Light Armored Brigade. I had still lived in London for 10 years, still arrived back in Swindon at the same time, still been up at Uffington picnicking the day before. Dad had once said the past had an astonishing resilience to change. He wasn't kidding. I thanked Bowden, hung up and painted for a while, trying to relax. When that failed, I went up for a walk at Uffington, joining the sightseers who had gathered to watch the smashed Hispano-Suiza being loaded onto a trailer. The Leviathan Airship Company had begun an inquiry and volunteered one of their directors to accept charges of corporate manslaughter. The hapless executive had begun his 7-year term already, thus hoping to avoid an expensive and damaging lawsuit for his company. I returned home to find a dangerous-looking man was standing on my doorstep. I'd never seen him before, but he knew me well enough.
"Next," he bellowed. "I want 3 months' rent in advance, or I'll throw you all your stuff in the skip."
"In advance," I replied as I unlocked my door, hoping to sneak inside and close it as soon as possible. "You can't do that."
"I can," he said, holding up a dog-eared lease agreement. "Pets are strictly against the terms of the lease. Clause 7, subsection B. Under pets, special conditions. Now pay up."
"There's no pet in here," I explained innocently.
"What's that, then?"
Pickwick had made a quiet plock-plock noise and poked her head round the corner to see what was going on. It was a badly timed move. "Oh, that! I'm looking after her for a friend." My landlord's eyes suddenly lit up as he looked closer at Pickwick, who shrank back nervously. She was a rare version 1.2, and my landlord seemed to know this. He eyed Pickwick greedily.
"Hand over the dodo," he said, "and I'll give you 4 months free rent."
"She's not for trade," I said firmly. I could feel Pickwick quivering behind me.
"Ah," said my landlord. "Then you have 2 days to pay all your bills or you're out on your sweet little speckop's arse. Capiche?"
"You say the nicest things." He glared at me, handed me a bill and disappeared off down the corridor to harass someone else. I didn't have 3 months advance rent and he knew it. After a search, I eventually found a lease agreement, and he was right. The clause was there in case of something much bigger and more dangerous, such as a saber tooth, but he was within his rights. My cards had reached their limit and my overdraft was nearly full. Specop's wages were just about enough to keep you fed and a roof over your head, but buying the speedster had all but cleared me out and I hadn't even seen the garage repair bills yet. There was a nervous plock-plock from the kitchen. "I'd sooner sell myself," I told Pickwick, who was standing expectantly with collar and lead in her beak. I stashed the bank statements back into the shoebox, fixed myself some supper, and then flopped in front of the telly, switching to Toad News Network.
"The Tsar's chief negotiator has accepted the foreign minister's offer of Tunbridge Wells as war reparations," intoned the anchorman gravely. "The small town and 2,000-acre environs would become a Russian-owned enclave named Bochkomos-Ishtoshnik within England, and all citizens of the new Russian colony would be offered dual nationality. On the spot for TNN is Lydia Startwright. Lydia, how are things down there?"
The screen changed to Toad News Network's preeminent reporter in the main street of Tunbridge Wells. "There is a mixture of disbelief and astonishment amongst the residents of this sleepy Kent town," responded Startwright soberly, surrounded by an assortment of retired gentlefolk carrying shopping and looking vaguely bemused. "Panic warm clothing shopping has given way to anger that the foreign secretary could make such a decision without mentioning some sort of generous compensation package.
I have with me retired cavalry officer Colonel Prong. Tell me, Colonel, what is your reaction to the news that you might be Colonel Pronsky this time next month?
Well, said the Colonel in an aggrieved tone, I would like to say that I am disgusted and appalled at the decision. Appalled and disgusted in the strongest possible terms. I didn't fight the Ruskies for 40 years only to become one in my retirement. Myself and Mrs. Prong will be moving, obviously.
Since Imperial Russia is the second wealthiest nation on the planet, replied Lydia, Tunbridge Wells may find itself, like the island of Fetla, to be an important offshore banking institution for Russia's wealthy nobility.
Obviously, replied the Colonel, thinking hard. I would have to wait to see how things went before coming to any final decision. But if the takeover means colder winters, we'll move back to Brighton. Chilblains, you know.
There you have it, Carl. This is Lydia Startright reporting for Toad News Network, Tunbridge Wells. The camera switched back to the studio.
Trouble at Mole TV, continued the anchorman, and a bitter blow for the producers of Surviving Cortez, the channel's popular Aztec conquering reenactment series, when, instead of being simply voted out of the sealed set of Tenochtitlan, a contestant was sacrificed live to the sun god. The show has been cancelled and an inquiry has been launched. Mole TV were said to be sorry and dismayed about the incident, but pointed out that the show was the highest rated on TV, even after the blood sacrifice. Brett? The camera switched to the other newsreader.
Thank you, Carl. Henry, a 2.5-ton male juvenile from the Kirkbride herd was the first mammoth to reach the winter pastures of Redruth at 6:07 p.m. this evening. Clarence Oldspot was there. Clarence? The scene changed to a field in Cornwall where a bored-looking mammoth had almost vanished inside a scrum of TV news reporters and crowds of well-wishers. Clarence Oldspot was still wearing his flak jacket and looked bitterly disappointed that he was reporting on hairy once-extinct herbivores and not at the Crimean front line.
Thank you, Brett. Well, the migration season is truly upon us, and Henry, a 200-to-1 outsider, wrong-footed the bookies when...
I flicked the channel. It was Name That Fruit, the nauseating quiz show. I flicked again to a documentary about the Whig political party's links to radical Baconian groups in the 70s. I switched through several other channels before returning to the Toad News Network. The phone rang and I picked it up. It's Miles, said a voice that sounded like 100 push-ups in under 3 minutes.
Who?
Miles.
Ah, I said in shock. Miles! Miles Hawke! The owner of the boxer shorts and the tasteless sports jacket.
Thursday. You okay?
Me? Fine, fine. Completely fine. Couldn't be finer. Finer than... how are you?
Do you want me to come round? You sound kind of odd.
No, I answered a little too sharply. I mean, no thanks. I mean, we saw each other only,
2 weeks ago.
Yes, and I'm very busy. God, how busy I am. Never been busier. That's me. Busy is a busy thing.
I heard you went up against Flanker. I was concerned.
Tell me, did you and I ever...
I couldn't say it, but I needed to know. Did you and I ever what?
Did you and I... Think, think. Did you and I ever visit the mammoth migrations? Damn and blast!
The migrations? No. Should we have? Thursday. Are you sure you're okay?
I started to panic, and that was daft given the circumstances. When facing people like Hades, I didn't panic at all. Yes, I mean no. Oops, there's a doorbell. Must be my cab.
A cab? What happened to your car?
A pizza. A cab delivering a pizza. Gotta go.
And before he could protest, I had put the phone down. I slapped my forehead with the palm of my hand and muttered, Idiot. 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 I then ran around the flat like a lunatic, closing all the curtains and switching off the lights in case Miles decided to pop round to see me. I sat in the dark listening to Pickwick walking into the furniture for a bit before deciding I was being a twit and elected to go to bed with a copy of Robinson Crusoe. I fetched a flashlight from the kitchen, undressed in the dark and climbed into bed, rolled around a bit on the unfamiliar mattress and then started to read the book, somehow hoping to repeat the sort of semi-success I had enjoyed with the Flopsy Bunnies. I read of Crusoe's shipwreck and his arrival on the island and skipped the dull religious philosophizing.
I stopped for a moment and looked around my bedroom to see whether anything was happening. It wasn't. The only changes in the room were the lights of cars sweeping around my bedroom as they turned out of the road opposite. I heard Pickwick plock-plocking to herself and returned to my book. I was more tired than I thought, and as I read, I lapsed into slumber. I dreamt I was on an island somewhere, hot and dry, the palms languid in the slight breeze, the sky a deep blue, the sunlight pure and clear. I trod barefoot in the surf, the water cooling my feet as I walked. There was a wrecked ship, all broken masts and tangled rigging, resting on the reef 100 yards from the shore. As I watched, I could see a naked man climb aboard the ship, rummage on the deck, pull on a pair of trousers and disappear below. After waiting a moment or two and not seeing him again, I walked further along the beach, where I found Landon sitting under a palm tree gazing at me with a smile on his face. "What are you looking at?" I asked him, returning his smile and raising my hand to shield my eyes from the sun. "I'd forgotten how beautiful you are." "Oh, stop." "I'm not kidding," he replied as he jumped to his feet and hugged me tightly. "I'm really missing you." "I'm missing you too," I told him. "But where are you?" "I'm not exactly sure," he replied with a confused look. "Strictly speaking, I don't think I'm anywhere. Just here, alive in your memories." "This is my memory? What's it like?" "Well," replied Landon, "there are some really outstanding parts, but some pretty dreadful ones too. In that respect, it's a little like Mallorca. Would you care for some tea?" I looked around for the tea, but Landon simply smiled. "I've not been here long, but I've learnt a trick or two. Remember that place in Winchester where we had scones that were fresh warm from the oven? You remember, on the second floor, when it was raining outside and the man with the umbrella?"
"Darjeeling or Assam?" asked the waitress.
"Darjeeling," I replied. "And 2 cream teas, strawberry for me and quince for my friend." The island had gone. In its place was the tea room in Winchester. The waitress scribbled a note, smiled, and departed. The rooms were packed with amiable-looking middle-aged couples dressed in tweed. It was, not surprisingly, just as I remembered it.
"That was a neat trick," I exclaimed.
"Naught to do with me," replied Landon, grinning. "This is all yours, every last bit of it. The smells, the sounds, everything." I looked around in silent wonderment. "I can remember all this?"
"Not quite, Thurs. Look at our fellow tea drinkers again."
I turned in my chair and scanned the room. All the couples were more or less identical. Each was a middle-aged couple dressed in tweed and twittering in a home county's twang. They weren't really eating or talking coherently. They were just moving and mumbling to give the impression of a packed tea room.
"Fascinating, isn't it?" said Landon excitedly.
"Since you can't actually remember anything about who was here, your mind has just filled in the room with an amalgam of who you might expect to see in a tea shop in Winchester. Mnemonic wallpaper, so to speak. There is nothing in this room that won't be familiar. The cutlery is your mother's, and the pictures on the walls are all odd mixes of the ones we had up in the house. The waitress is a compound of Lottie from your lunch with Bowden and the woman in the chip shop. Every blank space in your memory has been filled with something you do remember. A sort of shuffling of facts to fill in the gaps." I looked back at our fellow tea-takers, who now seemed faceless. I had a sudden and worrying thought. "Landon, you haven't been around my late teenage years, have you?"
"Of course not. That's like opening private mail."
I was glad of this. My wholly unlikely infatuation for a boy named Darren and my clumsy introduction to being a woman in the back of a stolen Morris 8 was not something I wanted Landon to witness in all its ignominious glory. For once, I was kind of wishing I had a bad memory, or that Uncle Mycroft had perfected his memory erasure device. Landon poured the tea and asked, "How are things in the real world?" "I have to figure out a way into books," I told him. "I'm going to take the gravitube to Osaka tomorrow and see if I can track down anyone who knew Mrs. Nakajima. It's a long shot, but who knows?"
"Take care, won't you?"
Landon stopped short as something over my shoulder caught his eye. I turned to see probably the last person I wanted to be there. I quickly stood up, knocked my chair over backwards with a clatter and aimed my automatic at the tall figure who had just entered the tea room.
"No call for that," grinned Acheron Hades. "The way to kill me here is to forget about me.
and there is about as much chance of doing that as forgetting little Hubbles here.
I looked at Landon, who rolled his eyes heavenward. Sorry, Thurs. I meant to tell you about him. He's quite alive here in your memories, but harmless, I assure you.
Hades told the couple next to us to scram if they knew what was good for them, and then sat down, tucking into their unfinished seed cake. He was exactly as I last saw him on the roof at Thornfield. His clothes were even smoking slightly. I could smell the dry heat of the blaze at Rochester's old house, almost hear the crackle of the fire and the unearthly scream of Bertha as Hades threw her to her death. Hades smiled a supercilious grin. He was relatively safe in my memories, and he knew it. The worst I could do was to wake up. I reholstered my gun.
Hello, Hades, I said, sitting back down again. Tea?
Would you? Frightfully kind.
I poured him a cup. He stirred in four sugars and observed Landon for a bit with an inquisitorial eye before asking,
So you're Park Lane, eh?
What's left of him.
And you and Next are in love?
Yes. I took Landon's hand as though to reinforce the statement.
I was in love once, you know, murmured Hades with a sad and distant smile. I was quite besotted, in my own sort of way. We used to plan heinous deeds together, and for our first anniversary we set fire to a large public building. We then sat on a nearby hill together to watch the fire light up the sky, the screams of the terrified citizens, a symphony to our ears.
He sighed again, only this time more deeply.
But it didn't work out. The course of true love rarely runs smooth. I had to kill her.
You had to kill her?
Yes, he sighed, but I spared her any pain, and said I was sorry.
That's a very heartwarming story, murmured Landon.
You and I have something in common, Mr. Park Lane.
I sincerely hope not.
We live only in Thursday's memories. She'll never be rid of me until she dies. And the same goes for you. Sort of ironic, isn't it? The man she loves, the man she hates.
He'll be returning, I replied confidently, when jack shit is out of the raven.
Acheron laughed.
I think you overestimate Goliath's commitment to their promises. Landon is as dead as I am, perhaps more so. At least I survived childhood.
I beat you fair and square, Hades, I said, handing him a jam pot and a knife as he helped himself to a scone.
And I'll take on Goliath and win too.
We'll see, replied Acheron thoughtfully. We'll see.
I thought of the sky rail and the falling Hispano-Suiza. Did you try and kill me the other day, Hades?
If only,
he answered, waving the jam spoon in our direction and laughing.
But then again, I might have done. After all, I'm here only as your memory of me. I sincerely hope that I am, perhaps not dead, and out there somewhere for real plotting. Plotting!
Landon stood up. Come on, Thurs. Let's leave this clown to our scones. Do you remember when we first kissed? The tea room was suddenly gone, and in its place was a warm night in the Crimea. We were back at Camp Aardvark, watching the shelling of Sevastopol on the horizon. The finest fireworks show on the planet, if only you could forget what it was doing. The sound of the barrage was softened almost into a lullaby by the distance. We were both in battle dress and standing together, but not touching. And by God, how much we wanted to.
Where's this? Asked Landon.
It's where we kissed for the first time, I replied.
No, replied Landon. I remember watching the shelling with you, but we only talked that evening. I didn't actually kiss you until the night you drove me out to Forward CP and we got stuck in the minefield. I laughed out loud.
Men have such crap memories when it comes to things like this. We were standing apart like this and desperately wanting just to touch each other. You put your hand on my shoulder to pretend to point something out, and I slid my hand into the small of your back, like so. We didn't say anything, but when we held each other it was like electricity. We did. It was. The shivers went all the way to my feet, bounced back, returned in a spiral up my body and exited my neck as a light sweat.
Well, replied Landon in a quiet voice a few minutes later. I think I prefer your version. So if we kissed here, then the night in the minefield was... Yes, I told him. Yes, yes it was. And there we were, sitting outside an armored personnel carrier in the dead of night 2 weeks later, marooned in the middle of probably the best signpost minefield in the area. People will think you did this on purpose, I told him, as unseen bombers droned overhead, off on a mission to bomb someone to pulp. I got away only with a reprimand, as I recall, he replied. And anyway, who's to say that I didn't? You drove deliberately into a minefield just for a legover? I asked, laughing. Not any old legover, he replied. Besides, there was no risk involved. He pulled a hastily drawn map out of his battle dress pocket. Captain Bird drew this for me. You scheming little shitbag, I told him, throwing an empty K-ration tin at him. I was terrified. Ah, replied Landon with a grin. So it was terror and not passion that drove you into my arms. Well, I shrugged, maybe a bit of both. Landon leaned forward, but I had a thought and pressed a fingertip to his mouth. But this wasn't the best, was it? He stopped, smiled, and whispered in my ear. At the furniture store? In your dreams, Land. I'll give you a clue. You still had a leg, and we both had a week's leave, by lucky coincidence, at the same time. No coincidence, said Landon with a smile. Captain Bird again? 200 bars of chocolate, but worth every packet. You're a bit of a rake, you know, Land, but in the nicest kind of way. Anyhow, I continued, we elected to go cycling in the Republic of Wales. As I spoke, the APC vanished. The night rolled back and we were walking hand in hand through a small wood to the side of a stream. It was summer and the water babbled excitedly among the rocks, the springy moss a warm carpet to our bare feet. The blue sky was devoid of clouds and the sunlight trickled in amongst the verdant foliage above our heads. We pushed aside low branches and followed the sound of a waterfall. We came across two bicycles leaning up against a tree, the panniers open and the tent half pegged out on the ground. My heart quickened as the memories of that particular summer's day flooded back. We had started to put the tent up but stopped for a moment, the passion overcoming us. I squeezed Landon's hand and he curled his hands round my waist. He smiled at me with his funny half-smile. When I was alive, I came to this memory a lot, he confided to me. It's one of my favorites, and amazingly, your memory seems to have got most things correct. Is that a fact? I asked him as he kissed me gently on my neck. I shivered slightly and ran my fingers down his naked back. Most block, definitely.
What did you say?
Nothing, block, block. Why? Oh, no, not now, of all times. What? Asked Landon. I think I'm about to... wake up. But I was talking to myself. I was back in my bedroom in Swindon, my memory excursion annoyingly cut short by Pickwick, who was staring at me from the rug, leash in beak, and making quiet plock-plock noises. I gave her a baleful stare. Pickers, you're such a pest, just when I was getting to the good bit. She stared at me, little comprehending what she had done. I'm going to drop you off round at Mum's, I told her as I sat up and stretched. I'm going to Osaka for a couple of days. She cocked her head on one side and stared at me curiously. You and Junior will be in good hands, I promise. I got out of bed and trod on something hard and whiskery. I looked at the object and smiled to myself. It was a good sign. Lying on the carpet was an old coconut husk. And better than that, there was still some sand stuck to my feet. My reading of Robinson Crusoe hadn't been a total failure after all.